This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Where Money Meets Heart. Triangle nonprofits look to grow services from every charitable dollar. And that's the headline on the front page. The article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline, Making Sure the Dollars Matter. Nonprofits are a huge business, but how can your money make the biggest impact? And this is written by Jennifer Henderson. Giving to a charity should be a hassle-free choice. But for businesses and individuals with a hankering for knowing how their dollars are spent, hassle-free often gives way to stress-inducing. The challenges only mount with a growing pool of potential options and the occasional headline-grabbing scam. North Carolina's nonprofit industry is enormous. While most are small, there are still many with substantial annual budgets. In the Triangle, for example, there are 40 charities with annual revenue topping $10 million. Nonprofits provide 10% of all jobs in the state and have an annual impact of $42.5 billion on the state's economy, according to the Center for Nonprofits. Some nonprofits have large operations with hefty salaries for their leaders. Triangle Business Journal reported 13 local nonprofits who paid their CEOs more than $200,000 in compensation. Leading the list was the $892,354 earned by William Hudson of LC Industries, which provides employment for the blind in Durham. Next on the list was the $383,374 earned by William Ziffel of the Divers Alert Network Foundation of Durham. But how should the effectiveness of a charity be measured, especially as a busy executive is considering places to donate? In the for-profit sector, evaluating a company gets down to fundamental financial metrics and ratios. For nonprofits, program services are at the heart of what charities do. Does the money really reach the children, the elderly, the poor, and those in need? Or does the money go to exorbitant employee pay or extravagant office space and fundraisers? So the amount of money that funnels into those services is a critical piece of evaluating a nonprofit's effectiveness. That's why program ratio, which shows the percentage of an organization's money that goes directly into its programs, has emerged as a popular consumer metric for evaluating charities. Looking at program ratio can give you a glimpse into the organization, says Damon Sercosta, executive director of the A.J. Fletcher Foundation in Raleigh. It's one metric among many that's available publicly that you should look at when evaluating a charity. But Sercosta cautions that there can be a broader picture and donors should give the process the due diligence of any other business transaction. Experts say to look at program ratio, but also to take the time to examine charities on factors like their overall financial health and how well they are achieving their mission. Charity's main work, program services. Those who donate to charities want to know how the money is allocated. Program ratio, essentially dividing an organization's program services expenses by total expenses, is a way to do just that. Places that rate nonprofits, such as Charity Navigator and the Better Business Bureau, note percentages of 75 and 65%, respectively, are considered standard or acceptable. For discerning consumers, the higher the percentage, the better. But many in the nonprofit field say those percentages may not paint a complete picture. There has for too long been discussions about how low expenses, administrative and fundraising meaning, you're doing a great job if all of your dollars are going to programs, says Tricia Lester, acting president of the North Carolina Center for Nonprofits. It's not healthy to starve the infrastructure of an organization, she says. For example, she says, take the scenario of charities having their employees work on old computers or depriving them of necessary training simply to avoid certain expenses showing up anywhere other than programs on their publicly available Form 990s. Sandra Minuti, vice president of marketing at Charity Navigator, says that while program ratio is one piece of evaluating information, there are additional financial and accountability metrics that play into the process. Newer charities, along with those operating in higher-cost industries or geographic areas, have the potential to be unfairly penalized when it comes to this metric. For example, a museum and a food bank would have entirely different facilities and staff costs. Museums have expensive collections and property to maintain, according to Charity Navigator, while food banks generally have lower overhead. GuideStar says financial metrics such as program ratio can be helpful in terms of evaluating charities in certain instances as those of similar size and age that are located in the same area or similar locales and that have similar missions and programs, and in cases of tracking a nonprofit's progress over time. But even so, there may still be limitations, according to GuideStar, like varying accounting methods and special one-off circumstances that create heightened expenses in categories outside program services alone. Those in leadership positions at charities, including organizations with a high program ratio, echo this sentiment. Rod Brooks, CEO of Raleigh-based Rise Against Hunger, says not having an extensive donor engagement team has been part of the organization's program ratio success. We literally have hundreds of thousands of volunteers who are out raising money for their events. The money that they raise for their events is just under 80% of our cash budget, he says. But while program ratio is something that Rise Against Hunger pays attention to, it currently is just under 90%. Brooks says the organization is much more focused on what it's doing and achieving in regards to its mission of ending hunger. As for SAVE, Students Against Violence Everywhere, which has a roughly 86% program ratio, the organization remains focused on getting funds where they need to be, and that's to the chapters, says Executive Director Carlene Ray. The organization, based in Raleigh, historically has been focused on diversifying its funds, she says, in areas like grants, educational item sales, and donations. Other ways to evaluate. So how should one evaluate a charity? If I'm evaluating a charity personally or in my role at the Fletcher Foundation, I look at the people, I look at the project, and I look at the finances, says Sir Costa. Financially, diversified funds and revenues trending in the right direction are two main measures to review, he says. Lester of the Center for Nonprofits also notes that revenues can be an important financial aspect aside from program ratios for donors to examine. And Charity Navigator's Minuti says, we recommend that donors check the charity's financial health, accountability, and transparency practices and results. In terms of financial health, Charity Navigator recommends looking at the growth of program expenses, types of funding sources, costs related to professional fundraisers, and fundraising costs that may be allocated to program costs. All of this can be found in organizations' Form 990s. Financial metrics Charity Navigator utilizes in its own rankings include program ratio, fundraising and administrative expense percentages, and fundraising efficiency or expenses divided by contributions. It also looks at growth in program expense, working capital divided by total expenses, and an organization's liabilities divided by assets. Charity Navigator says much of that information should be available from organizations' websites. Also helpful can be whether the organization has donor privacy, whistleblower, and CEO pay policies. Consumers can gain information about actual results, the charity's ability to bring about long-lasting and meaningful change in the lives of people and communities, through their own website and Form 990 research, as well as meetings with organization members, Charity Navigator says. At the same time, no amount of financial research equates to the insight a consumer gains by visiting charities in person. Most charities will want engagement from givers and not just their money, says the Fletcher Foundation's Sir Costa. When it comes to evaluating charities, perhaps the best way to learn if it's a cause you want to support is involvement, according to Sir Costa. Consumers will learn the most from visiting in person and participating in the efforts firsthand, he says, and that will produce invaluable insight into how it's actually operating. A good nonprofit is not going to want just your check, but also your engagement, he says. Rise Against Hunger's Brooks says that his organization is the first to say that we will never end hunger just by feeding people. We have to create really a movement to end hunger. With an issue like hunger, it's so easy to be apathetic. It's so easy to realize, well, this is 800 million people. How on earth do I impact the lives of 800 million people? What we provide is a very direct, hands-on way to get involved, he says. Spending 2 hours of your time, you can provide meals that will dramatically change someone's life around the world. And furthermore, when you scoop that cup of rice in the funnel, you're just one step away from feeding that child. Booming base. At the end of the day, donors want to know their dollars are making a difference. And the Triangle has a thriving nonprofit scene for donors to consider, ranging from healthcare and education to homelessness and hunger. The A.J. Fletcher Foundation, started by the founder of Capital Broadcasting Company, has its largest focus on education, according to Sir Costa, in addition to looking to help in other areas. We're a grant-making organization, says Sir Costa, noting over the last couple of years, those grants have ranged from about $5,000 to $1 million. Also having a large scope is Raleigh-based Rise Against Hunger. Previously called Stop Hunger Now, the nonprofit began in 1998 and has distributed aid to roughly 40 countries. Rise Against Hunger focuses on providing its global partners nutrient-rich food for distribution through volunteer-run meal packaging events. It also focuses on related aid and community empowerment. Of the 300-plus million meals that we've packaged in the last 10 years, more than 40 million have been packaged by groups in this area. More than 2,000 meal packaging events, Brooks says. Aside from meal packaging, the organization also offers opportunities to get involved through skills-based volunteering in areas like business development and supply chain operations, he says. When I started 10 years ago, I think we had 5 people on the staff and a cash budget of about $800,000, Brooks says. Currently, we have a little over 100 full-time positions, 40 of which are in Raleigh, throughout the organization, and a cash budget this year of about $23 million. The organization also employs between 30 and 40 part-time facilitators for its meal packaging events, he says. As for how it should be judged, Brooks says the best way to evaluate a nonprofit is simple. If we're going to measure the success of a nonprofit organization, it ought to be on what metrics that organization is using to determine whether or not they're being successful in achieving their mission, he adds. And Sir Costa's advice is to simplify your efforts. Instead of giving to 500 or 50 charities, pick 2, 3, or 4 and treat them like you would a business partner, he says. And now we're going to turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, the editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Program Services Key to Nonprofits Performance. Reporter Jennifer Henderson's deep dive into the performance of the Triangle's largest nonprofits offered up some interesting perspectives for me. For one, it looks like most of our nonprofits are performing at or above levels considered appropriate for a 501c3 entity. What was surprising, however, is how the organizations that track and rate the efficiency, productivity, and overall mission of nonprofits want us to deviate from one key measurement, program services. GuideStar and Charity Navigator are two national organizations that track nonprofits of significance. And Charity Navigator rates nonprofits as well, meaning a nonprofit with a low grade may have trouble raising money. For an individual or an organization looking to write checks to charities, I believe a nonprofit's program services ratio is the most important barometer. I would like to know what percent of the money I am giving to a nonprofit is going toward the primary mission. If there are 100 other charities who spend more than 70% of their annual budget on program services, I'm focusing on them. If there are scores of them below 70%, I'm more than likely to pass on them. I have talked to enough check writers over the years to know they feel the same way. And yet, as Henderson's story points out, several stakeholders tied to the nonprofit industry believe that program services should not be the only criteria to judge a nonprofit's performance. They add that every nonprofit, based on size, geography, and mission, has separate needs that could affect ratios. Therefore, program services ratio should only be looked at holistically as part of a bigger picture. Here's a news flash. Nice try. If a nonprofit raises $2 million in 1 year from private and public sources, they should spend at least 75 to 80% of that money on its overall mission. The remainder can go into salaries, administrative work, replacing carpets, and buying new computers. Budgets need to be tweaked, salaries need to be adjusted, and hours need to be rescheduled to achieve that goal. If for-profits can do that, so can nonprofits. Thankfully, the numbers are high for the most part, although some nonprofit executive salary seemed a little too rich for a nonprofit. But if these leaders are maintaining program service ratios at 75% to 80% without playing accounting games, so be it. Nonprofits are part of an important business sector in our community. They play an uber-important role in our quality of life and often offer us an ecosystem of support for individuals, families, and organizations alike. So we want the rating agencies to be vigilant because their services matter to the folks writing the checks. That helps in building trust and compassion. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The first headline, she wants barbecue lean, clean, and profitable. Despite North Carolina's love of pork, Raleigh can be a food desert when it comes to barbecue. Towns across eastern North Carolina are packed with legendary barbecue places like King's in Kinston, Bill's in Wilson, and Wilbur's in Goldsboro, but the capital city isn't overrun with barbecue joints. So it startled Biz when Raleigh's Barbecue Lodge, which dates to 1979, recently closed and filed Chapter 7 bankruptcy. The Barbecue Lodge stated gross revenue of $2.1 million last year, but assets of $129,000 and liabilities of $513,000. So is the barbecue scene in Raleigh going belly up? Not at all. One longtime Raleigh barbecue place, Clyde Cooper's, dates to 1938 and is going as strong as ever. You can find owner Debbie Holt at the register at 327 South Wilmington Street, where the restaurant moved almost 3 years ago. The waitresses still call you baby and sugar. The music is from decades past. The hush puppies are fat and hot, and the barbecue is lean and flavorful, just like founder Clyde Cooper wanted it. Clyde was very specific. He wanted lean, clean barbecue with very little sauce, Holt says. And business, she says, is thriving. Holt says she was paying $6,000 per month for rent in her previous location and now owns the building and has a mortgage of $4,600 per month. The current location includes the same tables, booths, and awnings from the original site, but she now has room to seat 160 after the restaurant previously sat 79. She also says she keeps a close eye on all facets of the businesses, making sure the food is the quality she wants and that her costs don't rise. You have to be on top of everything, Holt says. She also has raised prices for the first time in 6 years. You can't give your food away, she says. If I do, I'll be like the barbecue lodge, and that's unacceptable. Raleigh sports leader gets honor from peers. Hill Caro, a longtime leader of the Triangle sports scene, is now a Hall of Famer. Caro, the CEO of the Triangle Sports Commission, was inducted into the Sports Tourism Hall of Fame of the National Association of Sports Commissioners. Caro, a former swimmer at UNC Chapel Hill, is best known for his visionary leadership in getting the U.S. Olympic Festival to the Triangle in 1987. That massive event jump-started the region's efforts as a hub for sports and had lasting implications. One, for example, was flowers were planted across Triangle highways, a move that was so popular, it continues to this day. Bulls offer new twist for foodies. The Durham Bulls want to feed you this baseball season. The Capital Broadcasting-owned baseball team announced 8 different homestand food specials for its 2017 season, and they've moved beyond a hot dog and Cracker Jacks. Think brat burgers, tater tot waffles, and even Brussels sprouts. General Manager Mike Burling said his team had been busy creating unique, creative, and savory delicacies. Food is a huge part of the game day experience, and this season we wanted to take the next step in assuring our fans have a variety of food to choose from each time they come to DPAP, he stated. And fans can choose what to try at the Bulls' first homestand by voting online. They can pick between the Chili Mac, Tater Tot Waffles, or Blue Munster Burgers. The Bulls' first home game of the regular season is April 10. Apollo 13 astronaut returning to Chapel Hill. Here's a little historical fact you might not have known about the Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center in Chapel Hill. Between 1959 and 1975, nearly all of the astronauts training with NASA were sent to Moorhead to learn how to navigate spacecraft by the stars. That included Apollo 13 commander Captain James Lovell, the man portrayed by actor Tom Hanks in the 1995 movie about the ill-fated space mission in 1970. Lovell will be making a return trip to Chapel Hill for a special appearance April 6. The planetarium is sponsoring an evening with James Lovell at 7:30 p.m. in UNC Chapel Hill's Memorial Hall to kick off its 2017 North Carolina Science Festival. McConnell Golf spending money to make money. McConnell Golf is continuing to expand. The Raleigh-based company has invested $7.3 million in renovating four of its 12 clubs around the Carolinas and Tennessee. McConnell Golf, which began in 2003, expanded last year by adding Providence Country Club in Charlotte and a club in Knoxville, Tennessee. McConnell Golf is renovating those and also the Country Club of Asheville, an original Donald Ross course, and the Old North State Club. Stepping down at Wake Tech, Matt Congleton is retiring as executive director of the Wake Tech Foundation, and what a difference Congleton has made. He started in 2005 when the foundation had $2.4 million and was spending $800,000 to help the school. Now the foundation has blossomed to $13 million and contributes $4 million per year. The last day for Congleton, 69, is March 31. Matt Smith took over as executive director last summer as part of the transition. It's been an unbelievable run, and Matt Smith will take it to the next level, Congleton says. And now we turn to the On Retail and Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The first headline, Whole Foods on Hold. The Whole Foods grocery store that has been mostly finished for weeks at the new Alston Town Center in West Cary could be sitting empty for a few months longer, at least until the company's next fiscal year begins in late September, according to multiple real estate sources. Whole Foods nationally has been rethinking the timing of new store openings and some store closings as it has battled increased competition from mainstream supermarkets. The company's same-store sales have declined in each of the past six quarters, and it announced in February it would be closing nine stores while opening six others. Delaying the opening of the planned new Whole Foods store at Alston Town Center, located at the intersection of NC 540 and NC 55 in Cary, would mean that Whole Foods could push most of the expenses incurred with that process, including the stocking of shelves and hiring and training of staff, into the next year's budget and financial reporting period. Whole Foods hasn't confirmed the postponement, but its representatives also aren't offering additional details for a potential opening date for the 35,000-square-foot store. We don't have anything new to share on the Cary project at this time, Whole Foods spokeswoman Betsy Harden stated in an email. Whole Foods has reported that it has 93 stores in development, but it currently lists only four locations as coming soon on its website. The list includes a new store planned at Waverly in Charlotte, but no mention of Alston Town Center. The West Cary store, developed by American Asset Corporation of Charlotte, is slated to be Whole Foods' second location in Cary and the company's sixth in the Triangle. Popular Wisconsin restaurant chain to make debut. Wisconsin native Eric Newdecker, now living in Wake Forest, is planning to bring a little slice of his old home with the planned opening of the Triangle's first Culver's restaurant. It will be located at 2819 Rogers Road in Wake Forest at the corner of Heritage Center Drive. The quick-service, family-style restaurant specializes in big burgers and frozen custard shakes, with its Wisconsin cheese curds thrown in for good measure. Neudecker is working with CODIS Properties of Greensboro to identify sites for as many as 10 future locations in the Triangle. Chapel Hill apartment sold for nearly $73 million. Only weeks after putting the finishing touches to the final units at the Alexan Chapel Hill apartment community, a new owner has taken over. Berkshire Group of Boston has acquired the 265-unit complex for $72.75 million, county records show. The property, which also includes 13,560 square feet of retail space, will be called Berkshire Chapel Hill. Berkshire acquired the six-story building next to Village Plaza on South Elliott Road from a joint venture between Roger Perry's East-West Partners of Chapel Hill and Trammell Crow Residential. Triangle Real Estate Veteran lands new role. Commercial real estate brokerage veteran Sue Back has departed her role at Foundry Commercial in Raleigh and joined Davis Moore Capital's Raleigh office as a partner. Back, a repeat winner of Triangle Business Journal's Space Awards for top lease deals of the year, has represented clients such as Duke Clinical Research Institute, Humacyte, and Chimerics in their efforts to expand into laboratory and research and development space in the Triangle. And finally, in remembrance, Jim Baker mentored many younger brokers fresh in the business and gave of himself to ensure their success. That's from Triangle real estate veteran Rex Thomas commenting on the unexpected death of Lundy Group president Jim Baker on March 23rd at age 61. Over his more than 30-year career, Baker helped develop multiple office properties across the Triangle and was a partner in the proposed 20-story Center City project in downtown Raleigh. And now we turn to the On Energy, Transportation, and Tech page written by Lauren Onasorge. The first headline, Natural Gas Pipeline Headed to Eastern North Carolina on Target. The effort to bring a natural gas pipeline to Eastern North Carolina is on track. That's according to spokesman Aaron Ruby, who says the Atlantic Coast Pipeline has reached mutual easements with more than 60% of the landowners impacted by the project. The 600-mile pipeline, a collaboration of subsidiaries of Dominion Resources, Duke Energy, Piedmont Natural Gas, and Virginia Natural Gas parent, Southern Company Gas, would make natural gas fracked in West Virginia available to the state. It has already been prioritized in a report attributed to President Donald Trump's administration. Harrison Fell, an energy economist and associate professor at NC State University's Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics, predicts Trump's overall energy stance bodes well for the project's future in the state. As we've seen with the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Keystone Pipeline, they're going to push to get these through, he predicts, though he cautions ACP has been in the works much longer than Trump has been in office. The utilities behind the effort crossed one of their final hurdles in December when a draft environmental report was released by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The impetus for the project has been access. As Fell points out, there are not a lot of pipeline resources to get natural gas to this part of the state. While the Trump administration has repeatedly pointed to jobs as a highlight of projects like this, Fell says any created out of ACP will be, for the most part, temporary construction positions. ACP's Ruby says pipeline construction is expected to support more than 4,400 jobs in North Carolina. Once the pipeline is operating, we've projected close to 1,000 new jobs as a result of energy cost savings and expanded access to natural gas in areas that currently have limited or no access today, he said in an email. While the pipeline continues to receive criticism from environmental groups such as Appalachian Voices, it has scored strong support from the business community in recent weeks. Groups such as Halifax Horizons, Lake Gaston Regional Chamber, and the North Carolina Economic Development Association recently spoke out as supporters. Of the 2,900 landowners impacted by the project, 1,000 are in North Carolina. North State aviation woes to impact global transpark. As Winston-Salem prepares for the exit of aircraft maintenance firm North State Aviation, Eastern North Carolina too braces for job cuts, and the global transpark in Kinston, targeted by the company for major growth, faces another unrealized expansion. North State Aviation announced in September 2015 that it would open an aircraft maintenance center at the global transpark, a move that officials said at the time would create 109 jobs over 2 years and involve a $900,000 investment. The project even scored a performance-based grant from the One North Carolina Fund of up to $250,000. While the North Carolina Department of Transportation confirms North State Aviation is leasing nearly 40,000 square feet, encompassing a hangar and adjacent warehouse space at Global Transpark, the grand plans never materialized. According to Lenoir County, North State Aviation had just 17 employees working at the site by the end of the year. It's the second recent expansion plan for Global Transpark that hasn't met expectations. In 2008, airplane parts manufacturer Spirit AeroSystems was approved for an incentives package worth nearly $250 million to bring more than 1,000 jobs to the Global Transpark. Recent figures put its headcount at around 660, a far cry from what the company had initially promised. Spirit terminated its JDIG in 2015 after receiving about $1.4 million from the state. The company had to pay back nearly $100,000 of its $180,000 One North Carolina grant, North Carolina Department of Commerce records show. North State Aviation's news took local officials by surprise. Mark Pope, Economic Development Director for Lenoir County, learned it was cutting jobs from a notice filed with the state about North State Aviation's Winston-Salem facility closure, one that meant more than 300 job losses in the triad. He hasn't heard directly from North State Aviation on its global transpark operations. He says it didn't look good, particularly in light of a statement by CEO Gary Smith that, due to declining revenue and difficult business conditions, the company would soon begin winding down operations. Anytime you've got job losses, that's hard, says Pope. No matter where they are in the state, that's not good news for North Carolina. The expectation is that it has left Global Transpark for good. While an executive told Triangle Business Journal the company hasn't operated in Kinston since last fall, Pope says that wasn't made clear to local officials. The company had been working with a pair of charter services at the site, Miami Air International and Extra Airways. The airlines had rotated in and out at regular intervals, and another rotation hadn't been expected until late March or early April. The company's woes were not a surprise. Incentives require verification that a company is meeting hiring milestones. The state never had made any payouts to North State Aviation regarding its Kinston operation, its Kinston expansion, confirmed spokeswoman Beth Gargan. In September, the county paid the company $4,800 based on the few jobs it had created, Pope says. Boston's Log Me In grabs space in Raleigh. Nearly 2 months after combining with Citrix's Go-To unit, Boston-based Log Me In has signed a lease in downtown Raleigh. The next step could be following through on its growth pledge for the Triangle. Log Me In spokeswoman Colleen Nichols recently said the company plans to increase its staff by 50% in the region. As of February, Log Me In had about 60 employees in Raleigh, a small fraction of its more than 1,100 total headcount. The company, according to real estate sources, will lease 17,000 square feet of space at One City Plaza. While Go-To employees made up just a handful of the nearly 900 employees Citrix had in Raleigh last year, Log Me In has called the local workforce a priority. News spread last year that Log Me In was looking for space to accommodate a growing headcount, though initially those conversations centered around the warehouse district where the Citrix campus is housed. Since combining with Log Me In a reverse Morris Trust transaction in January, the Raleigh Go-To team has been operating at Citrix's campus, which is also crunched for space and plotting growth. Citrix announced in December that it, too, would be seeking out additional space. Its plan is to add 400 jobs in downtown Raleigh. Wake Tech to incorporate robot created by ABB into its program. Meet Yummy, a dual-arm, small-parts assembly robot that's coming to Wake Technical Community College in Raleigh. The robot, created by industrial giant ABB, will be incorporated into Wake Tech's new collaborative robotics program, a course that could have major implications on the Triangle's long-term economy. Greg Hsu, president of the Americas region for ABB, says the new program comes down to educating the workforce of the future. The Swiss company, which has its North American headquarters in Cary, has partnered with Wake Tech on education efforts for the past 5 years. Technology is moving faster than you can ever see it from the consumer side, he says. We have to make sure the workforce knows how to use it to deploy it. Stephen Scott, president of Wake Tech, sees past bridging the skills gap with tools such as Yummy. He imagines using Yummy to create a custom workforce for a specific employer considering North Carolina for an expansion, which could make Raleigh stand out to high-tech manufacturers looking for growth opportunities. He says, more and more jobs will be coming to Wake County as long as we can provide the skilled workforce. And now we have a section called She Said It, the quote. I'm just not sure what the bill's purpose is. The law that North Carolina has is enough. You have to be a licensed driver in North Carolina. And that's from Missy Cummings, director of Duke University's Humans and Autonomy Laboratory, talking about a recently proposed bill that would regulate autonomous vehicles. She fears it could derail her efforts to get a company to bring its self-driving car testing program to North Carolina. And finally, in a section called They Said It, the first quote, there needs to be a red hat of OpenStack, right? You need to have a vendor that does certification and confidently allows both hardware and software vendors to participate in the ecosystem. So I believe Red Hat is emerging as the Red Hat of OpenStack. That's from Jim Whitehurst, CEO of Red Hat, speaking to analysts after Red Hat announced year-end results. Having that high-speed connectivity definitely puts us in the ballpark of being able to go after a market that may not have been on our radar even a couple of years ago. That's from Chris Johnson, Economic Development Director for Johnston County, speaking after CenturyLink announced plans to bring gigabit internet speeds to parts of Smithfield. And now we turn to the On Life Sciences page written by Jennifer Henderson. Ex-Quintiles executive to aid Novan in FDA process. Former Quintiles executive Paula Brown Stafford has joined Novan as the company's chief development officer, a move Novan hopes will boost its chances of getting approval for its key acne drug. Stafford called Quintiles home since its beginnings in the 1980s and most recently served as its president of clinical development before departing in 2015. Quintiles merged with Connecticut-based IMS Health last year. We're extremely excited to have Paula Brown Stafford on board, says Nathan Stasko, president and CEO of Novan, noting that Stafford's extensive experience in drug development will benefit the company's entire platform. With the scope of how many projects we have and partnering opportunities we have globally with nitric oxide, it is important to expand our clinical operations infrastructure at this time. Her focus will be interactions with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration as it relates to SB204 for the treatment of acne. Novan is planning a pre-submission meeting about SB204 with the FDA in the third quarter. That could result in a new drug application submission in early 2018. I will be largely focused on collaborating with Dr. Joyce Rico, Novan's chief medical officer, and team to move SB204 through the pre-NDA meeting and NDA process, as well as moving SB206, SB208, and SB414 through their respective phase of development, Stafford said in an email. In addition, I will be further evolving the internal clinical capabilities and external partnerships to support Novan's robust pipeline. As for joining Novan, she credited the company's healthy, innovative product pipeline across four indications to date, an excellent management team, and a desire to develop safe and effective dermatological products not currently available to patients. Stafford will remain director at Health Decisions Incorporated and as adjunct professor at the Gilling School of Global Public Health at UNC Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill Sempra backs off plans to launch drug in European market. Amid a 67% workforce reduction following the FDA's rejection of its pneumonia drug, solithromycin, Chapel Hill-based Sempra is pulling back on its plans to launch the drug in Europe. The company said March 28 that it has withdrawn its marketing authorization application, MAA, aimed at approval from the European Medicines Agency for the drug to treat community-acquired pneumonia in adult patients. We believe the most efficient path to approval is to withdraw the MAA at this time and to resubmit it with the additional data requested by the FDA, said David Zaccardelli, acting chief executive officer of Sempra. In a complete response letter in December, the FDA rejected solithromycin due to liver-related safety concerns. Sempra said in February it had since met with the FDA regarding solithromycin. Based on input from the FDA at that meeting, Sempra is developing a protocol which will propose including fewer than 9,000 patients at the time we respond to the CRL, and will propose to deliver data from defined cohorts as the study progresses, Sempra stated. If the company and FDA agree on a protocol, Sempra plans to seek non-dilutive funding to support the execution of the study. Earlier this month, Sempra announced that it had hired Morgan Stanley for a review of strategic business options. As of December 31, the company had upward of $230 million in cash. The company is seeking to deliver value to patients and shareholders, and options may include sales, acquisitions, or partnerships. Argos receives termination notice for NCSU site. Months after signing a lease at NC State University's Centennial Campus, Argos Therapeutics disclosed on March 23 it has received a termination notice from the landlord. Argos intended to use the more than 40,000 square foot space for manufacturing. In an SEC filing, Argos said it received the notice from landlord Keystone Centennial 2 LLC on March 17 and that the termination was effective immediately. In the termination notice, the landlord asserted that the company was in default under the lease due to non-payment of invoices for upfit costs, Argos stated, adding it was not disputing the claim. Earlier this month, Argos announced a nearly 40% workforce reduction on the heels of an independent data monitoring committee recommending that it discontinue a Phase 3 trial for its lead oncology product candidate, Rocaprilisel T, for the treatment of metastatic kidney cancer. That was followed by a disclosure in the company's annual report that it needs to raise capital by next month to continue operations, and that one option could be to file for bankruptcy. The lease agreement was for 10 years, according to the filing. And now moving into the general news stories in the Triangle Business Journal. Final four means UNC Chapel Hill to cash in again. This article is written by Sugata Mukherjee. For UNC Chapel Hill, being at the Final Four to play for the men's basketball national championship is far from unusual. After all, the school has been there 19 times in the past. But the accomplishment has far more value than simply basketball and satisfying the school's rabid fans and those who jumped on the bandwagon in the past 3 weeks. For a public institution, a trip to the Final Four means an enormous bump in the school's brand. Wallet Hub, an online research firm, estimates UNC's men's basketball program has a value of $26.6 million, one of the highest in the nation, and far higher than the remaining three schools that made it to Phoenix. Not only will that number go up when the university officials are renewing their contracts with Nike, Adidas, Under Armour, and other sports apparel manufacturers, the academic side of the university benefits too. In 2017, UNC received more than 40,000 applications for enrollment in the fall. About 5,000 will enroll, mostly from North Carolina. National exposure like this often increases the applications pool from out-of-state students the following year, according to sports economists. With college costs rising and out-of-state high schoolers generally paying more in tuition than in-state applicants, the admissions economics at UNC could receive a boost as well if the university enrolls more out-of-state students. This trend of universities seeing a rise in interest because of athletic accomplishments really started to mushroom with former Boston College quarterback Doug Flutie's memorable act in 1984 when he led the college to a victory against the University of Miami Hurricanes with no time remaining. Boston College saw big increases in enrollment from applicants all over the country. Today, the Flutie Act is phrased as the Flutie Effect among college administrators. In 2010, MIT's Kyle Judah penned a paper titled NCAA Championships Are Changing the Game of College Admissions, and specifically picked the impact on UNC after the school won the men's basketball championship in 2009. Judah noted the number of applications at UNC Chapel Hill rose almost 15% from 2008 to the end of 2009 basketball championship season, a direct impact of more than $200,000 in application fees. Based on a four-year trend, Judah concludes UNC made an excess of $20 million from students that potentially would have never been interested in applying if not for the success of UNC's basketball team. Regardless of the NCAA men's basketball champion at the end, the direct fiscal benefit to UNC already is in motion. Now we'll turn to the small business section and read a column written by Harvey McKay, who is the author of the New York Times number one bestseller, Swim with the Sharks Without Being Eaten Alive, and Beware the Naked Man Who Offers You His Shirt. The headline, How You Can Be More Likeable and Why It Matters. No matter what business you think you are in, you are in the people business. And the more people like you, the better and easier life becomes. It's that simple. Likeability can get you where you want to go, whether it's a promotion at work, election to a political office, or building a wonderful circle of friends. People like people who are genuine, pleasant, sincere, and friendly. You can't please everyone, as the saying goes, but you'll do better on the job and in your life by being likable. Likeability is a skill, something we all universally can work on getting better at, wrote Robert Bargava in his book, Likenomics, The Unexpected Truth Behind Earning Trust, Influencing Behavior, and Inspiring Action. Bargava focuses on five main principles for businesses to be liked, and he uses the acronym TRUST, Truth, Relevance, Unselfishness, Simplicity, and Timing. Don't confuse likability with niceness. Nice people will try to make you feel better and protect your feelings, but likable people tell the truth. A perfect example is Steve Jobs, a tough love truth teller. He was blunt and transparent, which instilled trust among those who worked with him. And the people closest to him were devoted to him because they knew he would be straight with them. That holds true for coworkers and customers alike. Your customers have easy access to plenty of information about you, your products and services, comparative pricing, and your reputation. Trust is fundamental to being likable. Simplicity is critical to developing likability. Using plain language helps your message to be understood. Big words might sound impressive, but if they leave your audience wondering if they know what you were talking about, there's not much to like about that. When coworkers and friends enjoy your conversation and companionship, they'll be more eager to help you achieve your professional and personal goals. You can boost your overall likability by focusing on these areas. Listen to people. No one likes to be ignored. Pay attention when friends and coworkers are talking to show that you are interested in what they have to say. When you recognize and acknowledge other people's feelings, you are letting them know that you care about them. Give compliments. Tell people when you like something they've done. Honest praise and appreciation are music to everyone's ears. Even a simple good morning can do wonders. Take an interest in your coworkers and customers' lives. I always try to find out what turns people on: family, hobbies, vacations, goals, and so on. You can't talk business all the time. You might be amazed by the fascinating ways they spend their time. Participate in work-related activities. Even though you've already spent 40 hours or more at work, make an appearance at after-work activities or weekend events where possible. Getting to know your coworkers away from the office often enhances relationships at work. Use people's names. We all like the sound of our own name. Use names often to show that you know and value the person you're talking to. Ask for help. Most people want to help, and if you ask politely, they'll enjoy knowing that you respect their talents and always help others when they ask you for assistance. Admit your weaknesses and mistakes. Don't be afraid to show some vulnerability. No one's perfect, and pretending to be will usually alienate people. Honesty is not only the best policy, it's likability insurance. Share your passions. Passion can be contagious. Friends and coworkers will respond to your goals if you express them sincerely and enthusiastically. You might discover that others have similar dreams. Show a sense of humor. You don't have to try to be a stand-up comedian, but be willing to laugh at yourself and your mistakes. And if you need a little boost after you put all those strategies to the test, here's one last idea that I've heard works wonders. Clean out the office refrigerator. You will immediately move up the likability scale. And now we turn to the executive voice question and answer column. It's focusing on Myla Leigh Goldman. And there's a box headlined Closer Look. Name, Dr. Myla Leigh Goldman. Title, CEO, age 59. Family, husband, Eric Leigh. Daughter, Brianna Leigh. Hometown, Chapel Hill. Education, BA, University of Pennsylvania. MD, Columbia University. First job growing up. My father was a part owner of a liquor store in New York City, one block from Madison Square Garden. I helped in the back office, making sure money was properly counted and ready for the bank. The headline, Bringing Precision to Cancer Research. GeneCentric has big plans for 2017, and this is written by Jennifer Henderson. Dr. Myla Leigh Goldman, former Chief Scientific Officer and Medical Director of LabCorp, has spent the last 6 years at the helm of GeneCentric, a Durham-based precision medicine-focused company founded in 2011. As CEO, Leigh Goldman is leading GeneCentric through new investments and partnerships, as well as expansions in space and headcount. GeneCentric announced in January that Bristol-Myers Squibb made a $6.1 million equity investment centered around a new collaboration between the two companies involving genomic testing to classify cancer tumors. GeneCentric now plans to double its headcount to 10 employees in the coming year and grow its physical presence with a new lab. What motivated the founding of GeneCentric? My work as the Chief Scientific Officer and Medical Director at LabCorp allowed me to study the challenges of bringing new discoveries from the research stage to the patient. I learned there were several key accomplishments, initially scientific but others business-related, that needed to occur for these advances to make it to clinical care. GeneCentric brings together Dr. Chuck Perot and Dr. Neil Hayes from the UNC Leinberger Comprehensive Cancer Center, along with my informed business model, to translate life-saving cancer discoveries to patient care. The early years of my medical training were deeply impacted by the emergence of HIV/AIDS. In the 1990s, new treatments for HIV were developed and guided by cutting-edge molecular tests measuring the amount of virus in the blood, viral load, as well as the sensitivity or resistance to specific drugs, genotyping and phenotyping, which changed the course of the disease. My team at LabCorp was intimately involved in developing and implementing these new assays. Participating in the change in the course of the disease was tremendously powerful and rewarding. In the mid-2000s, my family was impacted by cancer, and my thoughts changed to, why can't we do for cancer what we did for HIV? How did you get the name GeneCentric? I wrote down all combinations of words that might make sense for a name and then Googled them to see which ones were still available. I had one or two possibilities, and the founders all agreed that gene-centric fit our goals. What is the potential of the company's cancer subtype platform? The cancer subtype platform is a universal genomic classification of tumors, allowing more effective drug development and more accurate diagnosis and treatment of patients. CSP identifies biologic subtypes through an integrated analysis of tumor genomics, leading to rational clinical trial design and an accurate prediction of drug response. The company's assays have the potential to become companion diagnostics, tests defined in the label of the drug and used before it is prescribed. Hatteras Venture Partners and LabCorp Ventures are both investors in GeneCentric. What have those relationships meant for the company? Both Hatteras Venture Partners and LabCorp have been supporters of GeneCentric since its founding in 2011. In addition to funding, both offer strategic support critical to the success of the company. Hatteras has a universe of relationships which provides connections with multiple people and entities for its success. With LabCorp, we've collaborated on the science side, which has allowed us to gain some benefit of their economies of scale as we've navigated the earliest stages of bringing our technology to market. How has GeneCentric grown and progressed since its founding? When we founded GeneCentric in 2011, the mission to change the classification of cancer was just a concept on a blank sheet of paper. While still modest, GeneCentric has accomplished many things, including developing a new genomic classification that has the potential to transform cancer clinical trials. Most recently, we've signed a collaboration agreement and received equity financing from Bristol-Myers Squibb. This new funding allows us to expand our team, move into new space, and continue to validate our existing assays while continuing to diversify into new tumor types. What do you hope to achieve in 2017? I'm hopeful that our work in 2017 will lead to universal recognition that our cancer subtype platform is a major advance that will help make precision medicine a reality for patients. And we'll have to stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.